to turn on my voice recorder, and eventually I'm going to put the podcasts on the website. I'm a little behind. Someone wants everything, don't they? Well, let me think about that. Okay. Well, let me tell you, if you haven't seen the latest homework assignment, I'm going to talk about it in a moment. Actually, I don't like writing on the edges of that stuff. There's going to be a couple minor changes in the syllabus. And we're not going to follow the order of topics in Gonzales and Woods. Basically, we're going to dramatically expand on spatial image processing, which is what we're doing right now. But we're going to really expand on edges. Since edges are really, well, basically it comes down to there are two things which we use to represent images. We either represent them by edges, or we represent them by regions. And if you start and think about it, you know, these are just like graphs, and you're talking about nodes and edges, and they have that kind of relationship. We're not going to talk about regions for a while. Now, what that means is that image domain processing moves down here. Image domain processing is the standard low-pass filter, high-pass filter, band-pass filter, frequency domain techniques. That's not going to be all that necessarily useful. But we will especially emphasize edges, concentrate in spatial image processing. Then we're going to move into geometric transformations. Okay, and this is going to get us into warping, not to be associated with Star Trek, and also with image registration. Okay, what this means is we are going to develop techniques for, given that I know reference features in one picture or one image, very simple techniques for transforming it to the same reference coordinates in another picture. In other words, if one's distorted because I moved or something, I can automatically overlay them and compare them. Now, we will follow that, and I'm not sure of the order here. We have two topics, and they're sort of interchangeable. One is color, and I'll comment on color in a little bit. It relates a lot to the edges and regions. And if you've taken a look at some of the images, as I see some of you have already, color might have some value, especially when applied to those images. And the other is going to be something interesting, which is cameras, image formation, and camera calibration. Now, none of these topics in the middle have been in this course recently. For the DARPA stuff and the mobile robots, I'm basically moving a lot of my computer vision material down into this class. So that's a 500-level class. Don't worry. We'll do it at a 400-level. But that's what we're going to be doing for the next couple weeks. Any questions on that? And we'll try and keep the homework sort of focused on mobile robotics. Now, as long as I've got the camera on, your assignment is to have some fun image processing some images that we took with a camera running around University Circle, Cleveland Heights last Friday. The first thing is there, by the way, the file that was sent to me had 2,130 images in it. We're not asking that you process every one of them, okay? But I just want to point out some features in here, and it's interesting. It doesn't show up very well because we've gone through the original optical camera that scanned them in. We've printed them out, okay, and then we've re-scanned them and displayed them again. But if you look at these lane markers very closely, at least on my stuff when I blow the image up, I get very nice, sharp basically, I see rasterization, or sometimes you might call it pixelation, but basically you're seeing the result of a discrete image raster. These images are only 240 by 320. Basically, it's low-resolution video. That should actually make it a little easier for you. Now, the one thing to worry about, which actually I guess these are two things to worry about, depending on what you end up deciding to do, there is no only way to do this assignment. But the first thing is the images aren't square. They're rectangular. They're 240 by 320. The second thing is that the images are not black and white. They're color. And I'm not going to talk until we get to the section on color, what a color edge is. Okay? Color edges, there's a whole lot of different interpretations of color edges. And people start to talk about things in multidimensional vector spaces and gradients, or they'll talk about things like local eigenvector expansions and all kinds of nasty stuff. We will approach that one a little carefully. But color edges are up in the air. I will also point out, what I didn't think about until I looked at these images closely is I didn't realize that all the patches, you notice that we have an awful lot of dark tar or asphalt patches on the road, which we definitely don't want to detect and drive along those. Needless to say, we'd never get anywhere if we followed those. I'm sure that Cleveland is an infinite, has an infinite number of those patches. The other thing, by the way, which you can do with a laser camera, I use laser camera in a sort of a very broad sense, is you can actually measure all potholes as you drive along. And maybe as we run our robots in the winter, it might be wise to come up with a local pothole index for the city of Cleveland. That might be fun. Now, remember earlier where I said that there would be potential effects due to shadows? This is actually a good image. Look at that overhead there, and notice that you wipe out the lines there. Edges, we tend to think of them in a very broad sense as boundaries of objects. Edges that we're going to find out, at least in today's talk, are really nothing more than local. And by that I mean spatially local within small regions, mathematical things which are just derivatives. It's when we start hooking them all together. It's when we start building edge models, things like that, that we really can start to use them maybe for navigation. And we'll talk about that. And in fact, one thing which I didn't think of but we might be able to use is the fact that all of the lines that we might want to use for navigation show perspective. If they don't show perspective, then they may not be useful. By the way, what is perspective? I use that word without talking about it. It means vanishing in the distance. And that will come up under camera calibration. I'll show you, for those of you who are robotics types, I'll show you how it is built into the standard 4x4 homogeneous coordinate transformations that you used in robotics. And for those of you who didn't take robotics, don't worry about it. It's really a pretty simple concept. It's only a 4x4 matrix. Okay? So that ends up to be a really interesting image with shadows. And just think, it'd be great if one of you came up with a mechanism for processing 2,000 of these in real time. No, that was... Boy, I'm not quite sure what the... Well, they're about, a tenth of a second, 15th of a second apart, so 6 per second, so you can figure out that's a reasonable length of time. The race itself is it 60 kilometers or 70? Anyone here remember? Something in that order. And what is it? We have 6 hours to drive it? Something like that. It's not super fast, but it's not slow either. Now, this is the other side of the problem. Obeying speed limits. Now, I think that DARPA would be so happy if you failed because you exceeded the speed limit and nothing else. You'd get at least a very good honorable mention for that one. If that's your only problem, I would not worry about it. Okay. This is now actually from the robot sitting at an intersection. Completely different problem. And we'll be looking at both of these problems through the course of the semester. This is well back from the intersection. The intersection's up here. You've got vehicles running across the intersection. Well, and they're going to be traveling at probably typical urban speeds, which I guess in Cleveland means anywhere between 20 and 80 miles an hour. But in principle, this should be like 30, 35 miles an hour. And I haven't actually, since you have the time between images, with this being stationary, the camera being stationary, you'll actually see displacements of the vehicles as they move across. And an obvious way to handle motion, has anyone ever studied video compression, video codecs, MPEG, anything like that, looked into it? No. Well, it turns out everything's based upon motion. We're going to be talking about that a modest amount. And the simplest place to start with motion is just subtract two images. Fundamentally, as long as you have two images and you know the time between them, you can actually compute lots of things. For Bill, he wants to compute optical flow, which is going to be a three-dimensional differential equation with constraints. You may or may not want to do that when you look at it. But it turns out it's built into all video compressors. And they do that in hardware, and they do it very, very fast. And we'll talk a little bit about those, but this is not a course in video compression. So the big picture is we're going to look at differences to see if we can detect just the vehicles. And that means that there will have to be constraints. Vehicles are bigger than one pixel. You're not interested in little teeny tiny things. Okay, and even here, when we're talking about edge operators, you can compute a derivative at every location in the picture. Not every location is an edge. What's the difference? Okay, so with that, I'll let you think about and work on all of these. As I said, there is going to be no right or no wrong answer, and I've got to contact Scott. We actually graded all of the first assignment. Needless to say, everyone did very well. All the grades were between 8 and 10, and I think a preponderance of 10s. And we'll get that feedback. I'll try and get it to you on Thursday. But everyone did well for that one. Now, going to talk a little bit more abstractly today, because our book, if you take a look at it, is woefully weak on anything related to edges. In fact, I think there's only two pictures or two slides having to do with edges. Whereas I generated, I think, 25 pages here. Now, we're going to start with some basic concepts. And these come more from computer vision than from robotics. I'm sorry, from image processing. Basically, the first thing that you have to remember is that an image is really a continuous function. I mean, we've made it discrete because that's the nature of our cameras. It also turns out that's really nice to process it with a computer. Okay? But it really isn't. And in general, it's a continuous two-dimensional function. Now, I really shouldn't say continuous. There's going to be discontinuities in it. This is basically the intensity of the image. Now, in principle, what we've done is, if this is one line of our image, and this can be anything, and the dots are going to represent the values that we picked for our pixel, in principle, I can fit a polynomial through that. And, for example, for the image that you have, 320 pixels wide, in principle, I could fit a 320th order polynomial through it. That's probably not a very wise thing. You know, functions to the 320th order, not very good, but in principle, I can fit polynomials. And I can do all kinds of operations on those. I can does this thing go down? No. I think we're stuck with it. This one doesn't seem to be too cooperative. I can rip it off, but don't worry. We'll have everything online for you. Okay. The whole idea is I can fit analytical functions and do all kinds of mathematical operations on them. This is just like your signal processing course. It could be like a math course, to be honest. Okay? And we can do all kinds of models, and people do. Polynomials are very, very big. And we tend to do a couple different kinds. Okay, the absolute simplest thing that we do is that we fit maybe blocks or planes which are uniform. In other words, constant intensity. So this is a constant shade of gray. Okay, so we can fit constant planes. One of the big things is you're going to see me talking about bilinear. And, by the way, if you look into the middle of programs like Photoshop or stuff, you'll see these terms come up, possibly. Basically, what bilinear means is that I'm going to have a linear function in the y direction, a linear function in the x direction, and I've got a plane that goes through those, because what? Two lines determine a plane. That can be a plane at any angle, mind you. So, now, that's not necessarily the best thing to do with a 240 by 320 pixel image or whatever. What we usually do is we will approximate the image by a polynomial, over a small region. Now, you're going to see these called facets, and actually when we start talking about difference encoding, motion from difference and stuff, we will also use the term block. We'll use them in slightly different capacities. These come up in image processing all the time. Facet is just simply, I'm going to use a local mathematical model. Now, that might be over 5 by 5 pixels, 30 by 30 pixels, or something like that. Why do we call it facet? Imagine that maybe I digitized a head or something. And basically, it's represented by little pieces, which are planes at different angles, if I use a bilinear approximation. Or they could be more complicated, but they're independent of each other. Okay, and there's all kinds of other things aside from the constants and the bilinear, and this is all going to come up in image warping. Another thing that often comes up is the bicubic. You'll see biquadratics, bicubics. What we simply mean is that it's quadratic or cubic in each dimension. Okay, so for example, if we have a 5 by 5 area, or maybe even the whole image, but really a small area, we'd have a bunch of constants, and I think you can sort of see how these are going to go. We're going to go up to squared. Yeah, that's 4. And I'm going to go up to x cubed and y cubed. And I've got 10 coefficients in there. A lot of them. There's all kinds of techniques for doing fits. You know, if I've got a 5 by 5 neighborhood, I've got 25 points, I can use a least squares fit. I can do all kinds of things. Those are for a more advanced course. Now, what we're going to be doing is we talk about different sections of the picture having different brightness functions or different brightness values. And I'm going to power the projector up again because I want to show you. We're going to, if you remember the last time, we had a picture. It had some lines on it. It was a grayscale picture, some dots. We want to talk about if we had done something like either, well, we're not even going to fit a polynomial. This is just taking the samples, and we're going to do a difference. We're going to do a first difference and a second difference, and the idea is that's going to be the first derivative and the second derivative. We can do that with our polynomials. We could do it with a function that fit the entire picture. Derivatives can reasonably easily be computed. Okay, but this one's just too long to draw. Okay. And this was something that was done the last time. I don't think I brought the original picture with me. Oh, yes, I did. This is what it would look like originally. Okay. This was the figure out of the book. And you can't see it very well, but there was a dot, and it looks like it's right there. That corresponds to this spike. You see there's some brightness here. So we get darker, go down in value, come across. We hit that dot, that big one. Then we go across, and there's a line. And then we come here and hit a sharp, okay, change. All that's going on is difference in brightness functions. Okay? Now, normally, what we do with image processing of all kinds is these are discrete approximations. In this case, it's sort of a forward difference, okay? So it's going to be, we're going to compute the first derivative or the first difference. It'll be the value of the derivative here will be the value here minus the value here, so it's a forward difference, and divided by the spacing. Now, most of the time, what we do is we make the derivative, or rather the spacing, 1, because it, unless you want an absolute number, that the spacing isn't really all that important. It's just a constant. Okay? So, if you assume that's 1, that goes away, and we can just slide along that and compute our first derivatives. Okay, and you've got a constant slope there. Well, if the slope is constant, okay, what are we going to end up doing? Okay, it's not changing. Okay, and it's not a very high slope. Okay, it's basically moving down 1 each time. So we've got a slight negative slope. Okay, notice what happens as we hit here. We go to a constant value, derivative 0. Now, this gets into, and one of the reasons for just looking at this kind of stuff is you notice this is a forward-looking, forward difference. I get different results slightly if I used a backward difference. We're going to get differences in every direction we pick. And it turns out the direction is also going to be important. But anyway, notice as we come along, it's constant. We have a very large positive slope, a very large negative slope. This is interesting behavior to look at. All kinds of short changes, like maybe the lane markers, are going to behave like that when you scan across them. Okay, we've got some more constant values. Here is a wider line, and notice the changes in the derivative are smaller and broader. Okay, and then over here, where we have this one edge, we have a sharp increase in the derivative, it's positive, and then it just goes down back to 0. That's a first derivative. Now, we often compute the second derivative, and we sort of do the same thing. What is the second derivative? It's just the difference in the first derivative, 1 pixel spacing apart. Okay? And you now can go along here and compute that, and what's very important, you're going to see this over and over, is notice right here, okay, which corresponded to that original spot. This has a well-defined Laplacian-type behavior. This you'll see over and over again. Notice, very, very large negative value at the center, and then 2 positive values on each side. And if you go back and look at those masks that I gave you already without deriving them, that's sort of what a Laplacian looked like. And we'll talk about that a bit more. Now, a couple things is, how do you determine where an edge actually is? Now, for the purpose of driving a robot vehicle, we're probably very happy if we're within a couple inches, if even that. That basically, as far as things go, that's a relatively sloppy application. You don't need to be super accurate. On the other hand, people who do optical measurement get really, really interested in being accurate. And so that's where there's a difference between a forward difference, a backwards difference. The question is, where exactly is the edge? And you might argue, and this is a standard technique, you might look at the peaks. And there are people that will argue, you look at the first derivative, you take the maximum value. That determines the location. The other thing is, and this gets now into, you're already computing some of these edge operators, I compute a derivative, you can have a lot of change in the grayscale of an image. That doesn't mean that it's an edge. An edge is usually a large change in intensity. So normally, you might put a threshold. You might convert your origin. If your result, let me back up and say that slightly differently. If you take your original image, you apply one of these edge operators to it, you'll get usually a grayscale image, which is basically a plot of the derivative. It could be other things. We're going to cover those. Okay, but effectively, a derivative. The brightest and the darkest regions are probably where you have an edge, so you probably want to threshold it. If you threshold down here, for example, you might just get those two as potential locations. So with a derivative, you'll look for a maxima. What you often do instead with a second derivative, and even with a first, if you plot it, is it turns out in certain situations it's easier to estimate zeros than maxima. So if you have two extremes, it goes cleanly through zero, and that can be a better method for finding precisely the location of an edge. Okay? So there's lots of ways of finding them, but fundamentally, the key thing here is we're going to take simple differences between pixels, and we'll take them first order and second order. First and second derivatives. You could do more, but we're probably not going to do that much. Now, okay. Now, some simple ideas of edges. We're going to deal with continuous stuff, and basically we're going to expand from some simple concepts into some pretty useful concepts. And the simplest idea is we have some brightness B1 and some brightness B2. Okay? So we're just going from two light levels. And we're going to have B2 brighter than B1. Okay, so we've got something like that. And this is just the edge. And at every point along it, we have a change in brightness function. Okay, or intensity function. They're the same thing. Now, the big thing is that I can write a brightness function. That describes the brightness everywhere in that simple image. Okay? And basically, what I'm going to do is it's going to be B1, which is the basic brightness everywhere, plus B2 minus B1. And since this is a perfectly nice thing, perfect edge, I'm going to do a unit step function. And our unit step is basically going to have values 0, 1/2, and 1. Now, there are other ways you can define unit steps with no value in the middle, that is just zeros and ones. Don't worry. We're not going to do too much of this, and your homework isn't going to be mathematical like this. Okay? And we often do this in polar coordinates. Where we have a line at theta and rho. Don't worry, even that's not too important. The whole thing here is we just want to look at some simple things. Because what we're going to do is edges have direction. And that relates to the gradient. Okay? And let's compute some partial derivatives. Okay, and this is pretty easy stuff. The first term goes away. I get a B2 minus B1. The derivative of the unit step is the delta function. Okay? That makes perfect sense. We're not going to go through any mathematics of it, but basically, it's that. And that makes sense. There's a positive edge right there. It's just got a big value just at that point. And we pick up, okay, the delta and now you take the derivative of the argument with respect to x, and you just pick up a sine of theta. And you do the same thing with y. You get the same delta function, but you take the derivative with respect to y, and you end up picking up a cosine of theta. And the only reason for doing this is we're going to talk about stuff which is rotationally symmetric, angle-dependent, and polar coordinates are good for that. Okay. Brightness gradient. This is very common now when you process an image. It's just a vector of the two derivatives, an x derivative, a y derivative. Okay, technically, this has a magnitude and a direction. The magnitude is the sum of the square of the two. The direction would be the arctangent of the ratio of the two. But this is what we'll talk about when we talk about a gradient. Okay, now, the gradient is directionally sensitive. That means, like when I was talking about taking my threshold, actually on the drawing I got rid of, okay, taking the threshold to find the edges, that means that I'm going to have to do something in X or do something in Y, and it might be that I'm just interested in edges, period, irregardless of direction. Okay, I may not care about orientation. So we get into things like this. And I think you can sort of see what's going to happen here. If we take the individual partial derivatives, you square them, okay, you're going to get those b's. You square them, you're going to get a delta function squared, okay, and we won't worry about that. That's just an impulse squared. But notice what happens, sines and cosines, okay? And I'll put the first one in here. I'll put it forward, and then you've got your delta squared. Same argument. You have b2 minus b1 squared, cosine squared, theta, delta squared. And you notice, what's the big thing that comes out of the squared gradient? The angle goes away. I just have functions like that are attractive. Because if I just want to find an edge, I don't want to find its orientation. I'm not saying you don't want to find the orientation. You might. But if you have this, you can compute something like this for the entire image and then just do a simple threshold, and there you've got all of the potential edge candidates in your picture. Then you can go do additional processing on them. But one threshold. Now, one of the big things is obviously time. Squaring, things like that are not necessarily the best in the world. And actually, one of the things that's often done with the gradient to approximate a squared gradient really quickly is that. take the absolute value of the two and add them. And it turns out that actually works fairly well. And that can be computationally very, very fast. In fact, that might even have applications to some of the biological ways. If you find a gradient in X and Y, just take a magnitude and add them. You've thrown away your orientation for the moment, okay, but you may not care. Now, let's sneak up on second derivatives. Okay, the Laplacian. And I don't know if anyone remembers, but when I showed you, I think it was on the first day, maybe it was the second day of this class, those slides of different things, I had a picture of, I think it was an object that looked like that. And I showed you just a really great result from a Laplacian that found the edges of it. Well, what precisely is a Laplacian? Well, what is it? We're going to get into second derivatives. And they get computationally a little bit fancier. We've got our first derivatives over there. We're just going to take the derivatives of those, and you'll see something that you may not see too often. Okay, well, what happens when you take the derivative of the delta function? You ever talk about that in any of your courses? Yeah. Not very many, though. You actually get something called the doublet. Okay, which if you want to think of it maybe as like two impulses. Okay, but we're not going to worry too much about it. We'll just write it as delta prime. But it's technically something called the doublet. Same argument. I take the derivative with respect to x, and I get another sign, so I get sine squared. I do the same thing with the y squared. I get the b2 minus b1, the delta prime. This time, though, I pick up the cosine squared theta. This one gets a little nastier. The cross term actually and mathematically, just with these, I can do a couple kinds of different things. This is not, by the way you implement this. This is just to motivate you for things that we're going to be looking at. Okay? Because the Laplacian, some of the second derivatives, what happens? Okay, notice, those terms are the same, those terms are the same, you get a sine squared plus a cosine squared. What's that? One. So, what do you have? You'll just have the greatness difference, and you'll have that doublet. Now, this has actually all kinds of interesting mathematical nice things going for it. One is it's linear. You might like nonlinear stuff, but linear stuff usually means it's simple to compute. It will have a lot of good things for it later on in mathematical analysis. It maintains the sign. Because over here, when we were computing the squared gradient, you've got a b2 minus b1 squared. I don't know if it's dark you know, I don't know if it's going from light to dark or dark to light. There's no idea of sign. It went away. The Laplacian keeps the sign. And the big thing for us is that it's rotationally symmetric. This is a real big issue. Certain operators are sensitive to the x direction. Certain operators are sensitive to the y direction. In fact, if you stop and think about it, yeah, del b del x is computing only something in the x direction. Del b del y is computing only something in the y direction. And we're going to find out, as we implement a bunch of these things, there are issues in detecting edges that are at angles other than vertical and horizontal. That's a big deal. Okay? And you can come up with all kinds of other operators, like there's a quadratic Laplacian, which is, I guess, that why the only reason I wrote this down. I can do things No, that's okay. And you can do all kinds of fancy functions. Now, there's just some very simple math here. Derivatives, gradients, Laplacians, symmetry. Those are some of the things that we look for, and by that I mean rotational symmetry, that we look for in edge operators. Now, we approximate them, and actually, this is only one type of edge operator. I'm going to talk about at least two others in a little bit. But we approximate edges using derivatives. And you saw what I did earlier. Okay? I just took in that waveform that we had, I took a forward difference. Okay? And you can do the same kind of thing. And by the way, I'm going to switch back and forth between E's and B's. All of these mean image. Okay? And they're all the intensity. It doesn't really matter, okay? But and lots of times, even though I told you all images start in the upper left-hand coordinate, okay? Lots of times, I'm actually going to show my stuff with axes like that. Don't worry, just flip the Y. Doesn't change anything. Okay. And so here's a simple little 4x4. Now, one of the big things that people will argue about is where do you put the real physical location of your pixels? And we can put them in the middle. We can put them at the lower coordinates. It almost doesn't matter that much. Okay? Now, think about this. Let's compute the slope going across in the top row. Okay? And we'll use and I haven't said which distance is, but we'll put the spacing between centers, epsilon, and we'll assume that it's square. Real cameras are not square. Did you know you have to pay extra to get cameras which have square pixels? Anyone here ever work with a camera that had square pixels? A couple people. Okay, good. But you do have to pay extra. I'm not sure how much the premium is. It shouldn't be a big deal, but they do charge you. Okay. And is there any fundamental? Did I make a mistake?
What's the reason why they don't just make them all square pictures?
Because your televisions aren't square. And we also have to allow lots of times room for connections. So we can't use up all of the silicon. And by the way, if we put our sensors too close together, what happens is that charge diffuses between them and you get noise. So what you really want to have is a big space with a little pixel, with a big pixel in the middle. But in fact, for some of the kinds of stuff NASA does and industrial people do, instead of just having squares, they'll do things like that. Now, you have to probably be a government organization to pay for a custom camera like that. But they like it because what the whole idea is, this might be following something. And if a spot moves off, you've got it in polar coordinates, and you just want to keep it centered. So there are specialized cameras out there. Now, this starts to look like some of the operators that we've been using already, okay? Because you can see a 2x2, although we don't usually use a 2x2, okay? But what we actually do is we average the derivative. We computed it here, we computed it here, we take the sum and divide by 2. So technically, we're computing del E, del X, average. One of the things I did not say, and we'll see, by the way, when we finally do things in the frequency domain, derivatives are super noisy. They can make them good. And we'll talk about usually if you're going to use a derivative operator, you want to filter it to clean it up before you. It turns out that the optimum filter is actually the Gaussian. Now, what we did previously is, remember we talked about elements like this as an averaging filter. What you'll usually do is use something that's more center-weighted. And so you might do things more like that. Usually a 5x5 or a 7x7. But usually, and if you want to get ahead, you can pre-filter your image. Usually a Gaussian. And the reason it's called is if you would plot the intensity profile across it, would actually just look like that. And it actually, if you're really interested, shows by optimum filters, that's the optimum like edge in the presence of noise. But pre-filter it to get rid of the really tiny type frequency, and you'll get better results. Okay, so that's what we do here. And we just take the two and put them together. And you'll have two positive terms. Minus two negative terms. And each one of them had a 1 over epsilon, and now I've got a 2 because we're two of them. And now, let's think about this as a mask. If I look at the pixels around it, okay, a 2x2. Okay, what is it? EI plus 1, J plus 1 is a positive term. EI plus 1, J is a positive term. The mask now, corresponding to an averaged derivative, or the x component of greatness gradient, is this mask. You see now, this is starting to average. It gives you better performance. The bigger you make these, the more they average. But if you don't have a lot of small things in the image that you're looking for, you probably do want to average. And you can see I can make this 3x3, 5x5. I can make it as big as I want. And notice this is even. We usually don't do even. We'll usually do a 3x3 or something. You can do exactly the same in the other direction. You just take this minus that, and the corresponding y one would look like that. And so technically, we've just computed two components of a brightness gradient. Now, a comment on the brightness gradient because I did, there's one little thing I want to mention. There is the amplitude stuff. Okay, that's just the amplitude. And the bottom line is that you get a sine of theta and a minus cosine of theta out here, which is what determines the direction. The gradient always points in the direction of greatest brightness increase. That is an important thing to know. Okay, now, this is just something I was thinking of while just talking. I might comment that you don't have to necessarily compute the derivative everywhere in the picture. For example, if I'm looking at lines on a road, maybe I don't want to compute the whole doggone thing. This might be I'm only looking for something very structured. I might just want to compute a couple lines or a couple stripes, not the whole image. Now, admittedly, you have to think about whether you're going to miss and have a hole in here. Okay, but you don't have to compute everything. One of the things for you to think about as you're trying a couple different ways to do derivatives in this assignment is computational speed. You don't want to, all of this has to be done real time. You don't have too much time. That's why I made the comment that doing things like this can be pretty nice approximations. That is an approximation to the square root of and you'd probably say, boy, that's not much of an approximation to it. But it turns out in practice on images it works pretty well. And in fact, you might try that. You know, at this point, as I said, we're only concerned about edges, and even on the ones that you're given, these stripes are wide. It'd be nice if they were wider, but at the moment, they're wide. They're wider than one pixel. Okay? Now, we build up in all of this stuff. Okay? We've gotten 2x2s. We've done first derivatives. We want to get to second derivatives. Okay. And what are we going to do? We're going to take differences of first derivatives. And to do that, it's got to be clear that we've got to have at least a 3 by 3. Okay. And here, I'll pick the center. And I'll do I going that way, J going that way. And so this will be E, I plus 1, J plus 1. This will be the same thing, but all negatives. And then there's E, I minus 1, J, E, I plus 1, J, okay, no big deal. But we can start talking about the second derivative. And I think you're going to sort of see, well, let's suppose we do it in the center. And it would be the first derivative, let's see. And basically, I'll do the derivative here minus the derivative here. Okay, so I'm just doing it forward, and that would be at ij, if you want to think of it that way, and this would be at I minus 1j, and the spacing, we'll have the same thing that we used before over there, epsilon, and we'll have them all evenly spaced. And now, you just put in your first one, E, I plus 1, J minus E, I, J, divided by epsilon, minus, okay, E, I, J, minus E, I minus 1, J, divided by epsilon, and that whole thing's divided by epsilon. And now you start to see the characteristic of every second derivative operator. Okay? You have two positive terms. You've got a negative center term. Let's see, I've got EI plus 1J and EI minus 1. J, and that's over epsilon squared. Okay? And I can go, that's for X. And I did that. No averaging. I can do the same thing in Y. No averaging. And I'd simply get this one minus two of these, plus this one. Looks the same thing, just rotate it. That's over epsilon squared. Now, the Laplacian. Adding these two up. What does it look like? I get four positive terms. It's the four outline terms minus 4 times the center term divided by the squared distance. Okay? Now, I can make a mass that would correspond to those pixels. So if I'm computing the Laplacian for this pixel here in the center, what I do is look at the value of all the pixels around it, multiply that center one by 4, those by 1, and ignore the corners. This is my mask. I lay it over my image, multiply by the picture elements by these coefficients, I've developed a Laplacian. If you see a big negative in the center, it's a second derivative. And I won't get into the biology of vision, but there's an awful lot of discussion about, you know, biological systems computing first and second derivatives. And by the way, if you take a look in Horn's or Marr's book, David Marr, Vision, done way back in the 70s, he's the person who developed the original biological approach to vision. You'll find that eyes of people and monkeys and other things that have been checked out in laboratory experiments often duplicate these kind of functions. Not exactly the way we're doing it. And, you know, they do it in a very sloppy, noisy, analog manner. But they do a lot of them, and it works pretty well. Okay? Now, that's the normal Laplacian. Okay? It turns out that if you would actually take that and run it on an image, it may or may not work that well. Why? Well, it turns out it's very good at vertical and horizontal, but it left out the diagonals. It doesn't work well for those. And so we start to expand things. Okay. And I'm not going to relabel all of those. But what would be the obvious thing? Here we computed vertical and horizontal second derivatives. Why don't I compute diagonal second derivatives? And I can do that. And I'll compute it in x and y along each of these. Notice, in terms of the subscripts, what I just computed was this difference right here. EI plus 1, J plus 1 minus EIJ. And notice, it's epsilon, epsilon, so the actual distance between the center is the square root of 2 epsilon. Okay? And I can compute the rest. And might not be the most appropriate to call it x and y. Okay. Maybe plus 45 and minus 45 or something. Okay. I'm sort of really being sloppy here. That's not good math. And I think you can see how this comes together. It's the same thing, basically. And it's going to look like this one, minus twice the center, minus this one down here. And the only difference is it's over 2 epsilon squared. So we pick up a 2. And we can compute the del y squared, and we can do now del squared e, del x squared, plus del squared E, del Y squared, because I can compute another one exactly like that, except for that diagonal, and I'll get something that in form looks exactly like this one. Okay? But what it'll look like is slightly different. That term. Basically, it's the four, some of the four corner terms. Minus four times the center one. Okay, and there's a minus 4 EIJ. And that whole thing gets multiplied by the 1 over 2 epsilon squared. Now, what does this look like as a mask compared to that mask over there? Pretty much the same thing, except it's the four corners. A minus 4 in the center. Now, to put things in perspective, I probably should point out that this is 1 over epsilon squared. This is 1 over 2 epsilon squared. So they're not exactly the same units. And what's often done is we sort of regard this as the XY sensitive Laplacian. We regard this as the diagonal sensitive Laplacian. What would be the natural thing? Add the two together. And that's what we do. And it turns out if you do two-thirds up and down, well, two-thirds rectangular plus one-third diagonal, you get something that looks like this. And this is approximately rotationally symmetric. And you sort of see what it looks like. You can see the cross-section now in any direction. Is it comes in, goes up, and does something like that. And if you go back and look at what did some of those second derivatives look like when I was computing them on just that line, you actually saw one that did exactly that. So I'm just duplicating the response. Now, you notice that our book didn't say anything about any of this, or the history of edge operators, or where they came from, other than their sort of derivatives. Okay? Now, we tend to like boundary representations. That's why we deal with this stuff. Anyone in here take graphics? I probably asked that before. You know about BREPs, boundary representations. Okay, that's when you get into the solid geometries and stuff. If you have the boundaries, we can create models, boundary representations of complicated objects. Okay, this is what we can put into object recognition. If you've got the edges, the inferences, they bound something that's common. Okay, when we do segmentation, you'll, as I said earlier, you've got two views of looking at things. Objects are defined by edges, or objects are defined by regions of commonality. For example, the stripes on the road, yellows, whites, maybe orange barrels. Now, not every road is going to have stripes on it. Okay. Now, this was one type of edge operator, the approximation of a gradient or a Laplacian, a derivative. There are two more types. One is template matching. I kept that. Good. I was better organized than I thought. So there's one. Two is template matching. We're going to talk about that next time. And this might have a lot of value to things like following a road. The idea is, if you know what you're looking for, use that as a model. In effect, it's a correlation. And the third type, and this is something that we use more in computer vision, artificial intelligence type applications, is we actually curve fit to intensity models. What this means, and it's sort of a little bit like the templates, but if I know what a boundary or an edge of something is going to look like, why don't I just go in there and fit a very complicated equation to it? Basically, I fit a complicated surface to a bunch of intensities. Now, these can be interpreted different in color. And we'll get into that a little bit later, but I'll warm you up with the basic idea of what is a derivative in color. Is it the derivative in red, the derivative in green, and the derivative in blue added together? Maybe. But what if you have small changes in red, green, and blue, but together you have a big color change? That might happen. So, well, we'll get into some broader ideas of edges. And in fact, one of the reasons why we're doing this is that color edges are not well defined mathematically. People aren't quite sure how you can best compute them. Okay? We're done for today. Now, you can tell me that you probably prefer seeing the PowerPoint slides with the color stuff, and we'll go back to that in a couple lectures. For color, certainly, but for camera calibration and this stuff, we'll do it the long way. And if you have any questions on the assignment, remember, there is no right or wrong. We're actually trying to see who comes up with the cleverest ideas.